Thank you, Grace. We'd now like to invite the other three presenters to come up to the podium, to the stage here, I guess. I'm at the podium. Other than to thank the four speakers, the four presenters, and to recognize that I think they've given us an admirable together a demonstration of the multifactorial nature of the linkages between food security, nutrition, and health, and the various factors that are interconnected in both causally and in terms of intervention, that I would like to leave the discussion to you and to them. So with no further delay. Let me invite people to come to the microphones, and we'll begin the questions. Raphael, just before you start, we've got until 12:30, so it's short. It's 15 minutes, so please keep your questions brief. Please identify yourself as well. We're a little bit behind schedule. We started this a little bit late. Where you're going to pay for it is in your lunch period, your lunch time. We will start the lunch immediately after this session in this room, and then convene again at 1:30. So there'll be a slightly shorter time for lunch than originally advertised. So Rafael, please identify yourself fully again.
Rafael Perez Escamilla, Yale University. What a wonderful session! I am very much impressed with it. This is a question for a comment first, and a brief question for Grace Eagland, because. As you know, the experience-based scales have had demonstrable adequate psychometric behavior, predictive validity, convergence validity in many regions of the world, developed and developing countries. And I really think that the next frontier of research regarding these scales is with indigenous Aboriginal communities. So your work, I think, is very, very important in that sense. And the question I have for you, did you look at any mental health indicators, stress, depression, and so on? And I ask this question because the few studies that have bothered to look at it find very interesting relationships between household food insecurity, severity, and poor mental health, which brings a whole new dimension of what food insecurity means to people.
Very good question and comment. We have a breadth of data in the adult Inuit Health Survey. In the children, we didn't assess depression or mental well-being. And we have just embarked on the very beginning of our data analysis related to food security. And the mental health, depression, we will be looking at that, as well as we're looking at sensitivity, specificity, predictive value, positive, negative, for each individual questionnaire item in the USDA scale, because a lot of broad surveys want to have one or two food security questions. And so we're going to be looking at that, CAP agreement, everything. And so we've just begun. So come back next year and we'll talk and see where the progress has been. Thanks.
My name is Sam Goldberg. I'm a McGill alumnus and retired teacher. A common feature in all of the panelists was a better management of food security, nutrition, and data collection obviously yields improved health results. Now, I understand the importance of being positive, but I think we have something to learn from failure as well. And I'm particularly interested and a little puzzled on the Canadian example. We're one of the wealthiest countries in the world. We spend a fair amount of money on social policies, and yet we have one of the poorest records in terms of conditions for our children in poverty and Indigenous peoples. Is there any reasonable explanation for this? I guess so, but I was also curious about the other panelists' discussion of any failures that they had as well as the success. We might learn something from those as well.
I would say that we have good data in Canada because people care. So we have the data on the disparities. We don't have really good data on disparities from other countries. And I think that that doesn't mean that disparities don't exist. It means that people haven't placed a value to even look. And so what we observed in Canada is just the beginning in terms of trying to turn the situation around. But at least there's, we have an Institute for Aboriginal People's Health Research in this country, and there isn't any country, I think, out there that can match that. So I think that, yes, we see disparities, and yes, there is a focused effort now to address them.
Thank you.
I can speak for other failures that are sad. Certainly, if you look at the sub-Saharan African continent, a lot of the failure to actually make progress in the indicators I was referring to is related to conflict, lack of infrastructure, HIV/AIDS. So, if you're not addressing all of those fundamental problems, you really can't make progress. And even if you try and you have, you shoot in nutrition interventions and you try to improve agriculture, if people die in prime age, you affect your agriculture. If people are constantly in conflict situations, you have these kinds of problems. Another failure in South Asia is India. There's a real disconnect there in terms of the economic growth that you've seen in recent decades and the situation of malnutrition, which is called a national shame. Lack of political will or of instruments to actually address the problem head-on is the main problem there, but one of the also critical underlying determinant of malnutrition in that country is women's lack of status. Women are born malnourished. They grow to be malnourished. They are less likely to go to school. They don't have the same status as men. If the government is not willing to fix that or to take measures, like in Bangladesh, there's been a lot of effort to improve women's status in order to make have a better progress in nutrition. So there's lots of individual stories of failure.
If I could just add to that, on a individual basis in the non-project, we did a follow-up with an anthropologist, an independent anthropologist, going in and asking who was successful, who was not successful, or who was less successful in the non-project. And many of these things that we're talking about at the national level, you see at the household level. So mother's health was one of the things that came out. If a mother was not healthy, she was not successful. Support and conflict within the household, whether or not she had the family support, whether or not she had the ability to make decisions, made a difference on how women saw those who were successful versus those who were not. So I think at the macro and at the micro level, we see very similar things.
Where am I? I'm over here. Yes. Next speaker, please.
My question is for...
What's your name, please?
Oh, my name is Nagar. I'm a Master's of Science student at the University of British Columbia. I'm doing a Master's in Nutritional Epidemiology, and I'm focusing on the disconnect between food security and nutrition. So, you mentioned briefly in your presentation how the incidence of malnutrition actually increases once complementary feeding starts. And so I was wondering what the most successful intervention strategies have been in that small time frame between 6 months to 24 months, and more specifically interventions that focus on catch-up growth for stunted children?
This is a long story, but basically the failure in growth doesn't start at the time of complementary feeding. It starts at birth. If you look at the graphs, the famous graphs that we all look at, which is plotting the world, all the different countries of the world, and looking at how weight for agents and height for age go down, in South Asia, they actually start small. So babies are born small, and then from the very first month, they just go down, and they go down all the way to 24 months of age, where they actually stabilize and don't necessarily deteriorate afterwards. And I personally don't believe in catch-up growth after the 24 months, so you need to intervene during that period. So the problems are that mothers don't exclusively breastfeed. Mothers might also not be healthy themselves, and so that's affecting the first 6 months, if you want. And then the complementary foods that are given are typically really not adequate. They lack micronutrients. They're not necessarily given in the right amounts, with the right frequency. Children have very high nutrient requirements at that age, and the food has to be fortified specifically for that age group. It's not enough to have corn soy blend fortified food like what the U.S. distributes in food aid. So it's a complex set of practices that have to take place during that age, and they focus on feeding the child appropriately, but also preventing infections. Children get sick all the time. In developed countries, if children get sick, they don't become malnourished, but in developing countries, if they get sick and don't get the right food, then they definitely just keep going down.
Next question, please.
Claudia Ringler from IFPRI. Marie probably thinks that I'm equating food security with nutrition.
It wasn't you.
So just to say, it's not my area, but I've been told that in South Asia and particularly Bangladesh, the entry point to address maternal and child malnutrition are the mother-in-laws. And so my question to the presenter from Bangladesh is, do you agree? And if yes, how do you address it in your surveillance survey? Thanks.
Well, when we talk about surveillance, it's basically providing information to the whoever is asking for the information, not particularly implementing any program. But in terms of providing information about mother's malnutrition and what are the causes, I think we can talk about the outcome in terms of how the mothers are, but not looking at the causes. But in the project, we have scopes for special researchers. For example, if we find something that's alarming and not has been addressed before, we have money as well as scopes for doing further data collection and going in-depth. So that could be one of the possibility to address that. But we don't have that scope within the surveillance system.
Okay, next question, please.
Noel Solomon from Guatemala. I have a quick question of curiosity to Grace Marquise, which is, in the study, which was a very feel-good video, was there any relationship between microcredit, successful maternal incomes, and increase in consumption of animal food products by their children? That's my first question.
Easy answer, yes. There was an increase in frequency of a variety of different animal source foods. Anna has looked at, initial look at the intake of protein and micronutrients that you would expect to be associated, and there's an increase in that, and there's an increase in weight for age Z-scores.
And it was causal. I mean, you have controls that suggest...
That's right. We have. He wasn't talking about, but we actually have control villages that we were collecting the same information on. Yeah.
And I have a comment on Marie Huel's discussion, which is a classical necessary but not sufficient paradigm, which is food security is necessary. Without it, you don't have anything further for nutrition, but it's not sufficient. And you pointed out some of the barriers between the two. I'd suggest that even taking food in the mouth is not sufficient to guarantee nutrition, and that all of the intervening of utilization and storage and conservation of that food are really important, and for the audience to take that away as an important message that what goes on in the organism with those nutrients is perhaps more determinant in the long run of nutrition. My only problem is the persistent use of undernutrition as a measure, just because it is so confounded by height, linear growth, that it really fails to give us enough on the nutrition side and gives us some delusions about where we're going.
You mean the use of underweight?
Underweight.
Yes, oh, we agree. We agree. The only reason to use underweight...
Because the data is there.
Is the data. Thank you. You answered your own question.
With the indulgence of the audience, I'll take the questions from the two remaining questioners at the microphones. We'll ask you again, keep your questions brief. But you can still introduce yourself.
Hi. My name is Anne-Marie Boulay. I'm a PhD student. I'm working on the environmental impacts from water use in a life cycle assessment perspective. Now, I'm looking at different impact pathways, one of them being what are the human health impacts from water deprivation for domestic use and agricultural uses. In my research, I came across information from the FAO saying that actually up to 50% of the burden of death and the DALIs generated from malnutrition is actually caused by water-related issues, water sanitations, or access to proper sanitation. I'm wondering what your opinion is on how important the actual access to clean water and sanitation is on the final human health impact and burden of death.
Who is the question directed to?
Whoever wants to answer.
I can say certainly, just quickly, it will depend in the region. I don't know overall. I actually wasn't aware of this statistic, but certainly in South Asia, you have a major problem of access to water and sanitation, whereas in Latin America, this is not the case so much anymore. So I don't think we can make generalizations, but maybe somebody from FAO can answer.
Well, maybe I wasn't clear. They actually state the importance of how the death caused by malnutrition is actually linked to missing water for drinking purposes, stating that through diseases, this will prevent maybe absorption of proper nutrients. I don't know, I'm not a nutritionist, but like the link goes through the domestic use, through the agricultural use. And then.
Mm-hmm. I would just add that certainly water's incredibly important and linked to many diseases. But young children also have a lot of respiratory infections, too, that we should remember. And so, and those are going to often be related to fever, which is going to affect intakes, children's intakes. So that's another aspect to keep in mind in addition to the water-related diseases.
I'm sure there's a lot more to explore on that issue, and hopefully we'll see those connections more this afternoon. Final questioner for the morning sessions.
Yeah, my name is Florence Roll from FAO based in Washington. It's a question to Marie. Do you think the linkages between nutrition, food security and health, which are obvious at the conceptual level, should be operationalized down the road at the country level from the planning stage, formulation stage and implementation stage? I would be interested in your response. Thanks.
Yes, thank you. That's a good question. Yes, definitely. When I refer to we need to work across sectors and we need to press all the buttons at the same time, nobody can do it alone. So I think the mention of necessary but not sufficient is exactly there. So we certainly are working very, very intensively at trying to link agriculture, nutrition, health together. We had a grant from IDRC to do that. We've been working on a platform on agriculture, health, and nutrition, which is doing exactly that. And we have a mega program to the CGIAR now to work exactly on that. So the objective is to work across the sector, bring the sectors together and make them work together from the planning stage, not just at the end look at outcomes and then look at impact, but design programs and policies together.
Okay, so again, let me thank you, the presenters, for making this a very stimulating morning and session, and to you, the audience, for your attention. Thank you.